Good morning, folks. That was one of my favorite singers, Angélique Kidjo, with Way Way. And welcome once again to Friday Morning Talk Radio, Positively Revolting. And I'm Melody Silverwolf. Ani Haynes will be joining me in just a moment. And hey, everyone, yesterday was Brigid, the Return of the Light, Candlemas, and all kinds of other holidays, including Groundhog's Day. All around the world, people celebrate the 6 weeks after the winter solstice, when the light seems to have actually returned and it's a little bit lighter in the evenings, and you start to see the flowers poking up. The daffodils in my yard are getting ready to bloom, and you know, spring is coming and life is returned to our planet. And it's a time when we rededicate ourselves to what it is that we seek, what it is that we do, a time when we set the tone for the year to come, what it is that we want to manifest, what it is that we want to increase. It's a time of new beginnings. And so we're going to talk about that just for a little bit this morning. And then at about 8 o'clock, we're going to have some very special guests who are going to be telling us all about an amazing new film that is going to be playing this weekend at the Hollywood Theater called The Trials of Daryl Hunt. But until that time, well, I want to talk a little bit about the spinning of the wheel of the year and where we are right now. As I said, it's a time to begin anew and to rededicate yourself to what it is that you're looking to create in the world. Personally, I've rededicated myself anew to fighting the powers that be, so to speak. Boy, and they are really being pretty egregious lately. And also to just really appreciating the truth of the beauty that lies all around us. You know, we get so caught up in all these, all these dramas around us, political and social, in our personal lives, in our work lives, you know, on the bus, people are, you know, whatever, having arguments. And we tend to be easily drawn away from remembering who we are, remembering why we're here, remembering what's good about this plane of existence. And there's a lot of things. And just forgetting to really appreciate each other, ourselves, the beauty of this planet, and the incomparable chance to be alive, to experience this life, and just interact with everyone else on this planet, just to walk down the street and see the sky and the trees and all that jazz. So that's the kind of thing that I've been thinking about lately. Especially, I think it's it's appropriate in terms of what's been going on in Washington D.C. lately. And there's not been a lot of not so great things happening. But I think it's important that we don't lose heart and that we renew ourselves in our conviction that we're on the right road and that our road is, is one that's going to ultimately, find success, even if it has a lot of ups and downs on the way. You know, I mean, if you're on the road that gets you where you want to go, it's just, there's just a lot of hills and valleys on the way, and there's just no way to avoid that. But that doesn't mean that we should give up and not walk the road. God, good morning, Ani.
Ah, good morning. Sorry, I was traipsing around.
And then knocking the headphones.
Traipsing around the building. Well, that's sort of why my traipsing's been taking longer. I'm a little klutzy this morning.
I see. So you're beginning this. You've initiated yourself into a new year of klutziness. Hopefully that will pass.
You know, I'm not thinking of it as a year-long trend, though perhaps it could be. And Lord knows it's been a reoccurring theme in my life.
So if at least the groundhog didn't trip over his own shadow yesterday.
Well, that's good, isn't it? I'm hearing what you're saying, Melody, and I think it's just, again, an important time to really focus on those internal rhythms.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And it's like I think those first stirrings, what I've noticed personally this week, I don't know, in my milieu, in my corner of the world, people are kind of antsy. People are a little restless. People are a little agitated.
Oh, yeah.
In fact, I think I said things that are a little stronger.
Oh, yeah.
Like, wow, folks are kind of losing.
They've been driving like maniacs on steroids.
Well, so at first I'm like, wow, people are acting intense.
Yes.
Like, people are just acting intense. And I'm thinking, oh, it's just me. It's just my perspective. It's
astrological
just,
in part.
You know, my the pool I swim in, whatever it is.
It's not just you.
Yeah. So then Teresa, my beloved, TriMet bus driver of the universe, you know, concurs, in fact, that it's sort of a citywide phenomenon that people are, well, really kind of antsy, really kind of agitated, just anecdotally, you know. We have no sociological studies to back this up, but
we don't.
Seems
we
like
better
people
begin
are a little
immediately.
Antsy. So I do what any good witch does. I start asking around. So I go to the coffee shop, and I go to the coffee shop where folks know me, and I say, "Hey, coffee shop, how are y'all feeling like yesterday, today?"
You did ask the employees of the coffee shop,
absolutely.
And not the coffee shop itself.
Well, I also asked the regular patrons of the coffee shop. Well,
there you go. But you didn't just go up to the building and start addressing it, I hope.
Sometimes. No, I did not do
that. I'd be worried about you.
No, I'm not talking to buildings at this time.
I would be taking you for a psychiatric evaluation.
I'm not doing that yet.
Okay,
so, you know, I asked around there. And, indeed, people are feeling agitated.
Oh, it's just like a bar, a coffee shop hears it all.
Oh, absolutely.
They hear all the regular patrons' woes and ups
and
downs.
See, that's why I thought that would be a good reality mm-hmm. check for myself and Teresa. And, in fact, it was confirmed all the mm-hmm. way around. And to me, it's kind of funny. That's not my normal experience of Imbolc. That's like when I usually think of Imbolc, to me, I don't usually think of that as a time of high agitation.
No, not usually.
But it makes sense.
Well,
to
yeah,
me that
I mean,
it
look
is.
At what just happened in, you know, the last week or so politically. I mean,
there's all kinds
but
of stuff.
As I said,
political,
it's also
but I'm thinking
astrological.
On a vibrational level
mm-hmm.
as well, though.
Mm-hmm.
When you're looking at, you know, inner rhythm cycles.
Yes.
When you are at the quickening stage,
mm-hmm.
you know, Imbolc is the quickening. It's as life returns to us. The year's been sort of rebirthed. You know, it's like the year has begun anew. But here we are, you know, actually feeling it, moving our toes, our fingers,
mm-hmm.
Really sort of looking out, popping up.
Starting to sit up and rub its eyes and look around like,
right.
Oh, another year.
And as you think about that kind of growth, you know, it's like increased awareness. And I think that people are feeling, you know, whether they're aware of being open and sensitive, you know, people are feeling this incredible pressure. As Melody was saying, look at what's gone on politically this week.
Well, and I also
and
feel
also
like
just
the truth is starting to pop its head up above the ground and the bud is forming.
Uh-huh.
It's going to burst forth, I hope, in full bloom before long. I really feel
the
like
truth
people
is daffodil.
I really do
think
people
it.
Are starting to, you know, on a
yeah.
greater level,
yeah.
starting to, the scales have been ripped from our eyes. And now that we've stopped screaming and we've taken our hands away, we're starting to blink and look around. We're seeing the truth, finally, you know. It's a good thing, but it's, you know, not always, change is not always easy.
Right. So, if you want to, gosh, I love coincidental timing. If you are interested in joining in this part of the conversation at 8 o'clock,
mm-hmm.
we will be switching gears,
mm-hmm.
As Melody no doubt has.
I have informed them of this, yes.
So, if you'd like to call in the next 10 minutes, talk about Imbolc and those cycles and that sort of thing, please do, 503-231-8187, and good morning to you. You're on the air.
Hello.
Hello.
Good morning.
Good morning. excuse me. I'm just thinking about something that happened, I don't know, 20 years ago or something, where when we were still having USSR and people were saying that there's different kinds of airwaves and, like, television waves and radio waves and things, and there's other waves too
mm-hmm.
that can be put out into the universe
uh-huh.
toward and can be directed toward people.
Well, they're not being. I don't think they're being put out. It's definitely a scientific fact that there's this wave of light that's been approaching us for some time, and it's been here for a couple of years now, and it's kind of a rolling tsunami, if you will, through the galaxy,
uh-huh.
and it's passing through, and it has a lot of properties that scientists have never seen before, and they don't really understand it completely, and I believe it is really having a profound effect on us in many ways, not just people, but you know, it's affecting the sun, it's affecting the magnetic field of the Earth a little bit. They're studying it, but they don't really completely understand it or what it might be, how it might be affecting our surroundings and the solar system. And I think that it's definitely having a lot to do with it, because this is something that they've never detected before. They don't really, it's unprecedented to scientists. They're sort of scratching their heads going, what is this and where did it come from? And, you know, what are its properties? And so I think that that could have something to do with
but
it, definitely.
But I was going to say, were you speaking of something else, though?
Like, like people deliberately raying people?
Governments do to other governments, other people's.
Right,
or
yeah.
Or in this case, maybe to them, to their own people.
Yeah.
Well, and you know, we have so many just, you know, unsecretive, you know, like cell phone radiation going on all the time.
Yeah, but that's not what she's talking about either.
But I mean, it's increasing. You know, that could be doing it to people.
That's, there's all kinds of stuff increasing, whatever. But I think the caller is actually asking about, like, you know, is the plausibility of
the CIA bombarding
the whole
something,
microwave, you know, beaming, control, you know, behavior controlling sort of technology. I don't know. And the weird part is, I don't know. It's like there are so much. It would be really cool to just say, oh, no, that, you know, I'm sorry, lady, what are you talking about? But in fact, there are so many psyops, so many covert experimental things. And in fact, you know, I remember reading about exactly what you're talking about. And I have no idea where that technology's at. I have no idea.
It definitely exists.
You know,
they
if people are using it and into what end they're using it. And I think that's weird that we, you know, we have no idea.
I know.
I don't think we're supposed to have an idea.
I know.
I think we're supposed to be just exactly like you're saying, going around going, oh, my God, something's happening, but we're not supposed to know what. And you can ask other people, and like you say, everybody's at a higher state of agitation.
Yeah, well, you know, I think it's always important to keep in mind that there is that whole milieu of covert ops that we don't know. And that's important to just sort of hold a space for in the back of our heads. Meanwhile, back at the ranch, with the economic pressures, with societal pressures being at a real fevered pitch in that culture war where people are feeling very polarized and very passionate about their very polarized positions, where people are feeling extremely overworked. I guess it gets back to that economic condition.
And now they all
have
to
a job,
pay the bills from Christmas.
If you have a job, you're actually, you know, having to work far more than you had in the past, or maybe you don't have a job at all, which brings its own, you know, pressures. When we're looking at the Patriot Act provisions and the sunsetting thereof and the additional provisions and the criminalizing of dissent, and if the recent, you know, amendments and all that stuff don't underscore the criminalization of dissent, the arrest of Cindy Sheehan for wearing a T-shirt during the State of the Union address, the rough arrest of Cindy Sheehan, a nationally known political figure, during a nationally televised event, you know, if you know, that isn't also having some bearing. If 65 days of rain with two days of intermission might not have some bearing. So there's like all of these factors playing in before we even get to the covert ops.
Yes.
But I don't think we can discount it.
No.
I just don't think we know about it. So it's good to hold open that possibility as another factor. But there's all these other factors that we can point to right now going, yep, all these things add up.
I do think the rain is having a lot to do with it. It's making people a little stir crazy.
Yeah, it's not the only thing. I mean, really, you know, it's like there's a big pot of stew.
Everything at once is the problem.
Yeah.
It's all kind of bombarding us.
I thank that caller for her call ever so much. And it's a really important point to keep in mind that we don't know what's going
that's the
on
thing.
That level.
We don't know a lot of what our government is doing, even the part that we should know. There's you can argue all day long about how much secrecy should a legitimate government be able to have of certain things, but certainly far less than there is now. And there's a whole lot of things that we ought to know about, just about general principle that we don't know. So God knows what they're doing in psyops that we have no clue about.
Indeed. Well, let's go ahead and take another caller. Good morning. You're on the air.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Yeah, your astute comment there that God knows. I was involved in the 60s in some projects with the CIA in Southeast Asia, and I know for a fact that whatever evil the minds of men can come up with, certain men will do.
Yes.
But I think in response to the unknown light wave, let's just call it the unknown light wave, and referring to St. Thomas Aquinas in the theory of the prime mover, that God does know. And I think that what's happening is, it's just like when you said, when you take your hands away and you really start to see what's happening, I think more and more people are becoming aware of the fact that there's such unjustified violence. Okay, if there's a monster in the world, a real monster, who wants to kill 6 million people because he doesn't like their religion, okay, it's fine to go out and snag him. But if you're all of a sudden this oil-dependent junkie who needs to go out and change everybody else's life so you can have what you want, there's no justification for that. And then whether or not you're asleep or awake at the wheel, all of a sudden it starts to come into your consciousness. And shows like yours reflect what Gandhi said. It doesn't matter what you do. It only matters that you do it.
Right,
and if
exactly.
If we have this community consciousness, which it's so hard to have when everybody's bombarded with materialism and financialism and the different things that make us like, you know, this consumer society, a word I hate. It's just so important that when those quiet little messages come to you and they say, you know, that old lady down the block don't have no way to get to go shopping. Go take her shopping. You know,
yeah.
reach out and do those small, you know, that the bumper stripper that makes the most sense in the whole world is perform random acts of kindness and beauty.
Yes.
And then it's so simple. If you do good things, you feel good about yourself. If you do bad things, you feel bad about yourself. So we're in this national consciousness now of being ashamed of ourselves. And
right.
There's clowns out there who would justify it because of their profit margin. And when you come before the judgment seat and he asks, you know, what did you do unto the least of me? Oh, I had to blow them up because I needed their oil. You know, makes me scared. I don't want to get branded with that brand.
Yeah, I think that's thank you very much for your call this morning.
Yeah, just keep up the good work, girls.
Well, you
thank
too.
You very much.
We all have our part to play.
And
this is Dominic. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye, Dominic. Very astute, as you know, couldn't agree more.
There's so much that needs to be done. There's no shortage of work to take on.
And you know, also this week, I have to throw it in there, we saw the passing of Stu Albert.
We did.
And I, you know, the Yippies, to me, really embodied seeing a problem, analyzing the problem, and coming up with a solution that would be engaging to people beyond themselves. They really had a flair for engaging the spectacle. And when you're talking about performing random acts of kindness and senseless beauty, to me that often involves a sense of play, a sense of pranksterism, a sense of really, you have to shift your perspective and turn the world upside down for a second so that you can see the random acts of kindness that need to happen and the senseless beauty in life as art.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that actually, you know, I know that the caller was actually referencing sort of a different, you know, milieu of kindness.
But it's all important.
But it's all the same sort of, you know, ball of wax.
Mm-hmm.
To have fun, to engage, to open your heart and be compassionate. And it's actually, you know, when you have fun and engage in a prankstery way, it's only really funny if you do it with an open, compassionate heart, because otherwise it comes off as mean-spirited and a little snotty.
Well, I mean, I guess it depends on what you do. Like,
personally,
I know,
in my observations.
One of our charming colleagues, David Liberty, who's the co-host of Matakwayasan, is a rock stacker. He stacks rocks in a very amazing way. And I love it when I'm driving along Interstate 84, and David lives out in the gorge and drives in every day. I'm driving along, la-la-la-la-la, down the freeway, and I look over to the side of the road, and there's some rocks that are stacked up by the side of the road. And I know that David or someone like him has stopped their car there and stacked those rocks just for everyone's enjoyment and edification and amusement and their own enjoyment. And, I mean, things like that are just, I mean, they make your day. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
Little pieces of just a gift to everyone. And I just think that that's a really, you know, that along with taking the old lady down the street to the store and, you know, picking up the trash on the street in front of your house and everyone else's on your block. I mean, all those things, they all contribute to making this the world that we want to live in as opposed to the world we don't want to live in. And it's all important.
Yeah, it is. It is all important. And it is important to do it with a compassionate heart. you know, stacking rocks. Fine example.
I mean, obviously you don't want to go
meditative work and
do
whatnot.
It in a mean way, no.
Right, but, you know, I mean, I can't imagine stacking rocks in a mean way because it's sort of by its nature meditative.
Yes.
You know, but you know, there's the fun with you or fun at you.
Well, yes.
And, in fact, people are engaged when it's fun with you. And that's what I'm talking
about. Yeah, you don't want to make, like if you're doing street theater, making fun of the observers is never a good idea. It's impolitic and mean.
And, you know, I think we're going to take this moment to go ahead and do some...
You know, before we do, we should tell them what time it is.
Look at that.
And
go
who
ahead,
they're
Melody.
Listening to.
Go ahead.
It's 8:01 in the morning, and you, my friends, are listening to KBOO Portland 90.7 FM. We're going to take a quick musical break, and we'll be back with our very special guest. See you in a few.
Good morning and welcome back. Thanks for hanging out with us this morning. Again, I'm Ani.
I'm Melody.
And now we are joined by two special guests. We have with us this morning Daryl Hunt, and we have with us this morning as well, oh my gosh, Katie Brown. Okay. And I know I've seen your name. And I really want to thank both these folks for being with us. We'll be also joined by Steve Adamson, who's the founder of the Portland International Nature and Environmental Film Festival. The reason that we have Steve on is because, this film festival, it's a way of independent producers getting to, actually, you know, there's a film festival that highlights the work of independent producers in specific topics. He can talk more about that. But one of these films, very special films, is a film called The Trials of Daryl Hunt. And I had an opportunity to see that last night. Katie Brown is indeed one of the producers of that film. And Daryl Hunt, of course, the subject of the film. Daryl has a pretty horrific story of injustice and wrongful imprisonment for 19 years in North Carolina. And it's horrible enough when it happens to one person, but we know, and I know many of our listeners are well aware, that this is not an isolated incident, and that, in fact, this is something that occurs in our country over and over again, state by state. This is a reality of people, and we need to deal with that. It's a reality based on racism, on classism, and it's something that we have to address, and that is really criminal injustice in our criminal justice system. So I really want to thank Daryl for taking the time to be with us this morning.
Thank you.
And I was hoping we could start out, for our listeners that aren't aware or haven't followed that case, in 1984, there was a murder and eventual investigation in which you were eventually accused and convicted of murder and rape of a young woman in Winston-Salem, North Carolina.
Right.
I was hoping you could just let our listeners know a little bit about your imprisonment and the efforts to get you released. And eventually, I understand, almost exactly 2 years ago, this eventually bore fruit, and you were released and exonerated. So, can you?
Yes. Good morning. I was arrested and convicted twice of the rape and murder of newspaper copy editor Deborah Sykes. And in 1993, when it was discovered that the prosecution had withheld evidence about the DNA, we asked the judge to let us do the DNA testing because the prosecution had said that it wasn't possible, but they had the files and they had the actual lab reports in their files. So we was able to get the DNA, and after the DNA came back and exonerated me, the judge said, "What?" The DNA didn't matter.
What?
And I stayed in prison 9 more years.
Mm-hmm.
Unbelievable.
And then, ultimately, the General Assembly in North Carolina passed a law that you can get retested DNA and have it put into a database. So the lawyer, who was my court-appointed attorney from the first trial, who worked all these years for free, filed a motion with the court to have them to put it in the data bank. And they still took 6 months just to get it to the data bank, and the judge had to threaten the SBI State Bureau of Investigation with contempt of court to make them put it in the data bank. And they got a partial hit, which was the actual murderer's brother, and they followed up on it, and the actual murderer was in jail getting ready to get out, And then he eventually confessed after they showed him that they had the DNA mm-hmm. match. And at that point, I was released on bond. And then I was released Christmas Eve 2003 on bond. And February the 6th, I was exonerated.
I'm just blown away by that. The things the judge that said it didn't matter.
The things that struck me over and over again were, you know, the points of your case like that at the various trials of your case, where you would have someone introducing evidence that seemed so solid, so common sense solid, and you would face the prosecutors or the judges that said, yeah, but whatever. We all know he did it. Whatever.
Yeah.
And, you know, I feel like I'm someone who, I know intellectually this sort of thing happens. We talk about it a fair amount, and yet I have to say, watching the documentary last night and seeing over and over again the injustice that you faced and the absolutely cold response of the so-called justice system was just chilling to me.
That's what makes the documentary so great, not just because I'm in it, but...
Which was a good darn there.
But it shows from the very beginning in 1984 when it first started, and it comes all the way up, and it shows the people that was actually involved who was making these ridiculous rulings. Even there's the Fourth Circuit Court of Appeals, and the magistrate said that she was that I was convicted. I wasn't convicted of rape. I was convicted of murder, and that she was murdered. That I was supposed to have murdered her, and then somebody came along afterwards and raped her to justify keeping me in prison.
And the whole justification thing, it just struck me as, you know, here was a really lazy, really sloppy investigation of rape and murder.
I would say.
And that was then, you know, followed up with you being arrested. It's just like, oh, we'll pick somebody that doesn't have the resources to fight, because I believe somebody actually was quoted in the film as saying that, you know, their goal was just having a conviction. They just wanted to settle it. You know, and
the head of the police.
Right, right. I was going to say somebody significant, yeah. Like the head of the police.
Like any generic person would do.
Well, no, not any generic person, because you have to. I mean, again, the dynamics of race and class, I think, very much play into this. It was, you know, here's a small pool. It's something the film brings out of African American men who were basically being. Can you talk about one other part of the film that just struck me like gobsmacked, you know, jaw dropping open, like when you were talking with your lawyers about being offered money to lie about a friend of yours?
Yes. The district attorney at the time, Donald Tisdale, had offered me the $12,000 reward just to say that Sammy Mitchell, who was a friend of mine, committed the crime, and I could walk, and I refused it, and he said, well, we're going to charge you. And the history with Donald Tisdale and Sammy Mitchell goes back when Donald Tisdale was first elected district attorney. Sammy Mitchell had an armed robbery charge or something that he was acquitted of, and Don Tisdale still had the stick. He still kept the grudge. And before I was charged, he actually went and gotten the stick out of his closet and slammed it on the table and told me that since you won't say that, I charge you. And they charged me with first-degree murder and rape.
Well, and so is there anybody in the state of South Carolina that is is speaking out against this, not just what happened to you, but this whole phenomenon of you know, injustice and racism in the justice system?
Well, there's actually the... He's retired now. Chief Justice Lake actually started a actual innocence commission.
Good.
Because of this, even mm-hmm. though they denied my appeal when he was on the court, after the DNA came out and the person was actually charged, he started this commission uh-huh. on actual innocence. And what they're doing now is going and trying to find, at least search the records in the prisons and find innocent people in it.
Right.
Because they know that the system is broke.
And, yes. And one of the ways it just became apparent that the system is broke is once they, not quite arbitrarily, you know, picked you from this pool because of this, you know, strange grudge match between, yeah. you know, the DA and your friend. But, you know, once you were in and accused and convicted, and all of these things, all of these pieces of evidence would appear to really be able to persuade a reasonable jury of your innocence, it seemed to me like the state's mode was then, we can't admit we're wrong at all yes. cost. And I think that goes to, you know, so many cases of wrongly accused. Doesn't matter if you bring me other evidence. I'd have to actually humble myself as the DA, as the prosecutor, as the judge in a previous case, and admit we could have been wrong.
Yes.
And that happens. There was another case. Actually, it happened in 1984, too, but it wasn't in Winston-Salem, North Carolina. It was in Burlington with Ronald Cotton and Jennifer Canino. Jennifer Canino was the actual victim, and she positively identified Ronald Cotton, but 11 years later when the DNA came out, it was Pooh, a guy named Pooh, and... You know, Jennifer accepted it, and the officers and the DA and all of those people worked together to bring about a just end. Just 30 miles down the road, Winston-Salem, is where I was. And it's strange because we actually went in court with the DNA 2 weeks before Ronald Cotton's DNA mm-hmm. came up, and we was denied, and
so much difference yeah. in just, you know, just so similar circumstances.
And now Jennifer Canino actually heads Daryl's Foundation, and they all work very closely yeah. together. It's kind of a crazy full circle, one of many in this whole story.
And about your foundation, that's another thing I want to make sure we talk about. And that is, after your eventual release, long struggled for, you were awarded, what do you call that, restitution, reparations, like compensation, that's it. That's
meager.
Very meager. For 19 years of your life and so much, not just 19 years, but 19 years of being falsely accused of a really hideous crime. And the impact that would have on anyone. So they give you a compensation package, and with that money you started a foundation, and I was hoping you could talk about that.
Yes, we started the Daryl Hunt Project for Freedom and Justice, and it has like three prongs to it. The first one is innocence, where we try to find people that's in prison that's actually innocent, like myself, help them get out, help them get past the hurdles
mm-hmm.
That they face, especially in North Carolina, that I know of, because that's where I was from.
Right.
And we work with the other innocence projects, other schools, and the second prong to it is the reentry prong for anyone getting out of prison. It's so hard to get out and make that readjustment. even though there's a lot of organization that has money from the government to do reentry, they're really not doing reentry.
Right.
They're just getting paid.
Right.
And what we do is actually try to help people get past that hurdle. And each client that we have, we don't call them clients, we call them associates.
Mm-hmm.
We take and help them get past their immediate needs, and then their responsibility is to make the next person that comes into the program, they work with that person because
right.
they have the experience of understanding what they're going through. And then we take the at-risk youth and we pair them with one of these and help them prevent them from going in. So that's a reentry program. And then there's education, which we do with the educating the public about the injustices of the system, doing reforms, trying to get the legislator to abolish the death penalty until they fix these problems.
Mm-hmm.
So we try to do all the educational programs that we can to make people aware of the injustices, because a lot of people are not aware.
Exactly, a point made very well in the documentary as well. There is a man, Larry Little, who was one of the major movers of your defense coalition,
right.
Defense committee, and there's a part of the film where he was saying that in essence, he was saying that, you know, even white folks really don't know this sort of racism was going on, because you know, it's like they could be in denial about it because mainstream media doesn't address racism, because stories like this are not told in the media where people are tuned in and getting their information and that sort of thing, and because you know, of all these factors. So getting that information out, getting education around these issues of injustice is so key. It seems like that really needs to happen before this is addressed on a nationwide level, for sure.
Yes.
Well, I mean, do you really think, though, that it's possible for people to be that much in denial? I don't know. I mean, I lived in the South as a child, and I know it's changed a lot since I was a little girl, but yet still, I mean, how you can doubt that people are still treated differently sometimes in the justice system, especially in the South, because of their skin color? I just find that hard to believe that anybody could think
wasn't
happening.
I don't think especially in the South applies.
Well, actually. But I think it's the most egregious there from what I've seen, although maybe not. But certainly has been, you know, when like I said, as a child, I've seen the most blatant racism I've ever seen in my life was when I lived there. But as I said, things are different now. But I really find it hard to understand how anybody could just pretend that wasn't happening.
On the criminal justice side of it, I think what happens is that everyone wants to believe that the police and the district attorneys who we hire and elect are doing the right thing, mm-hmm. that they would do justice, and so your trust is with them,
right?
Because that's what you're
right.
voting them in.
They're
for.
Doing their jobs,
yeah.
right? Right.
And it's hard to imagine that they would do something so intentional, and criminal. But it happens when you take and put money over life.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, and that's what it basically is. They need the conviction to get higher offices and mm-hmm. higher pay. So
yeah. Be elected. Yeah.
Yep. Katie, I want to talk to you for a moment. How did this documentary project start? How was it that people really banded together to tell Daryl's story in this format?
Well, It actually started in 1993. The two directors of the film, Ricky Stern and Annie Sundberg, all went to Dartmouth College together and got a phone call from a friend of theirs, Richard McGough, who was a private investigator on the case in 93, and said, you should come down here. There's something, you know, start shooting this. There's something going on.
So they were already involved in film at that time.
They were involved in film, but I had no backstory on this case until Richard had called, and they kind of got in a car and went down there with friends and started getting to the story and archived all the footage from 1984, which has been what makes this film so unique, because it actually follows this 20-year story where otherwise all that footage would have been destroyed.
Mm-hmm.
And all the news, all of it. And they shot off and on for 2 years, but then, as Daryl was explaining before, after the DNA came back and proved it wasn't him and he still went back to prison, funding dried up. I mean, there was... They were going to be the first, you know, DNA exoneration story, and there it was, 10 years and nothing.
But you think that would make some of their funders even more eager to see a movie made, because it was an injustice that was being committed.
But people were still, you know, didn't know what to believe, and they sat there, and they can talk, you know, speak on this. I'm sorry, they're not here to join us, but there were days when they sat there and said, well, I don't know. What do you believe? Because everybody, you know, it's easy to look back on it now and say it was such an injustice.
It was kind of new at that time.
Exactly. It was, you know. It was brand new.
Right.
Brand new. And so everybody kind of went on with their lives and other jobs and started to have families. And Mark called them in 2003.
And Mark is?
Mark is the defense attorney who's fought with Daryl for the past 20 years.
And what's his whole name?
Mark Rabel.
Sounds like we should erect some kind of a monument to
him. He's truly an inspiring individual. And that's when I came on board at that point, early 2004. And we're coming up on the 2-year anniversary of Daryl's exoneration, and we went back and shot and did all these follow-up interviews with everyone 10 years later, and it was a beast of a film with hundreds of hours of footage. And
oh, yeah. I can imagine.
Hundreds in all mixed formats, because it had been shot in film from 93 to 95. There was video from 84, and then we shot all new digital video and
must have been an editing nightmare.
And our editor, I wish she could see, but we had plenty of nights where it was a nightmare. And then at that point, Open Society Institute, the Sundance Documentary Fund, NextPix, the Anthony Radziwill IFP Fund, New York State Council of the Arts, all came together with grants and really helped us push through this to the end.
And what kind of recognition has the film received since its release?
We just finished it in the fall, and we had its world premiere at Sundance Film Festival last week. And we will be airing on HBO in April 2007. So we're going to spend the next year traveling the film to film festivals, starting our outreach campaign to get it into law schools, journalism schools, spark dialogue all across the country to people who would, you know, to the converted and non-converted.
Right.
And,
right.
And then post-broadcast, we're hoping for a theatrical release, and then to continue with our outreach campaign, and then eventually make it available for people to use as an advocacy tool.
Excellent. It's here as part of the Pine Film Festival, and Steve Adamson has joined us, and you're the founder of the Portland International Nature and Environmental Film Festival. So can you let us know what that film festival is about and how you've chosen this film?
Okay. Well, thank you, Ani. We're in our second year now, and as you mentioned, we started out themed nature and environment. And what we realized after our first year is, it's much bigger than that. We've expanded our programming, simply what we call it sustainability culture, social justice. But I think the real point is a point of respect. You know, it's respect person to person, person to place, generation to generation. It's a theme that cuts right through. Okay. Also, you're looking at it, you know, in another light. You know, our film festival now, it's about building community. And I think succinctly we focus on culture and community. And we bring in programming. I used to say we start with some local programming. We have some very good local programming and local filmmakers whose work are airing at our festival, and their constituency groups or community groups that build around those films. When we look at a film like Daryl's, the scene it tells us about, well, I'll take a step back and I'll talk about the nature piece.
Sure.
You know, nature includes human nature.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yes, it does.
a lot of folks, you know, when they hear the word nature, they think a nature show on TV,
right,
or something like that.
Marks and penguins, yeah.
Yeah. And it's, you know, it's a world apart. You know, but we're part of nature.
Absolutely.
Okay. Each of us is a living organism and system, and the way we act and behave and interact, we're a critter like anybody else.
Yeah, it's so true.
So in our programming, and then I'll look at the environmental piece too. Okay, it's not just about clean air and safe water and things like that. But when you walk outside, what do you have? You know, water, air, food. You run into people. You know, it's all part of the same piece.
Sure.
So when we look at a film like Daryl's film, you know, one, it's such a compelling story.
Mm-hmm.
Two, you know, it's an expose on human nature. And I think ultimately, if our programming wants to build community and just wants to, you know, address some of the social issues or just some of the issues we face in life that, you know, and we're looking towards, you know, a sustainable future, something that includes all of us, that enhances livability, you know, we have to look at these themes. We have to look at human nature. We have to embrace, you know, who we are. And I think starting at that level, then we can start, you know, addressing some of these injustices, whether they're in the criminal justice system or, you know, in other aspects of our community and society.
Well, you know, I want to remind everyone, this is a call-in show, folks. And if you have questions or comments, 503-231-8187. And I want to be sure people knew that the film, The Trials of Daryl Hunt, is going to be showing tomorrow night at 7 at the Hollywood Theater. And, you know, it's obviously, you know, something that you don't want to miss. Also, I wanted to mention that, of course, you know, this festival continues beyond tomorrow, does it not?
Actually, it doesn't. It's been running for almost 10 days.
So tomorrow's your last chance, and this film will only be shown that one time here in Portland at 7 tomorrow at the Hollywood Theater. So, you know, if you want to see it, this is your big chance until, of course, you'll have to wait for it to be on HBO in 2007. So once again, our phone number, 503-231-8187. And let me just remind you, everybody, what's coming up at 9 and thereafter. We'll have APA Compass with the topic, I Love Orientals, Cultural Appreciation or Theft. At 10, hear guests from Body Talk, a system of improved communication and synchronization within and between all the elements of the body mind for better health. At 10:30, Sounds of Awareness will feature Lisa Lieberman, author of A Stranger Among Us, and she'll talk about in-home support for children with autism or spectrum disorder. And at 11 on Democracy Now, hear about the story behind the Downing Street memo, and the director of Al Jazeera demands more information on the secret memo about Bush's desire to bomb Al Jazeera. Is there anybody he doesn't want to bomb? I just don't know. So anyway, that's going to be coming up. And, of course, then after Democracy Now!, we'll have Moving On, folk music at its finest. So don't go away. And, oh, this is very exciting. I've just received a note. We have free tickets to give away for the screening of The Trials of Daryl Hunt tomorrow night.
Well, we'll have to get details for that to our engineering pixie so she can be ready to conduct such a thing. And I think I can help her.
You think
so? Carry on boldly, will you?
503-231-8187. If you would like to call, make a question, ask a question, make a comment. So I guess I wanted to get back to you, Daryl. What? I mean, I know this is kind of a fatuous question. It's hard to answer it in a few minutes, but so what is it like for you now, having gone through all this, and now you sort of have your life back after a big chunk of it has been sort of cut out of the middle? I mean, What is it like for you now? How are you doing?
I just take it one day at a time. It's kind of hard at moments, not knowing certain things or not knowing what to expect, but then I give it to God and I just take it one day at a time and I just try to live that way.
What else can we do, you know?
Yeah.
Just to live our lives the best we can. Yeah. So have you, when you were incarcerated, did you believe that there were other people who were also incarcerated with you who were also innocent?
Yes, there's tons of innocent people still in prison all around the country. And in North Carolina, there was people that was coming up. The unfortunate thing is that unless there's DNA evidence, it's kind of hard to prove. And in my case, DNA evidence didn't make a difference. So that just shows you how much the system is broke down, because people don't understand about the levels. My case went all the way to the U.S. Supreme Court, and I was denied at every...
That blows my mind. I just don't understand that. But, you know, I do know for a fact that there was at least one person who was executed in Texas who the courts were well aware had not committed the crime. Some other fellow had already confessed to the crime, but they went ahead and executed him anyway because, this is their rationale, he got a fair trial.
Yeah.
That just made my head explode. Like, you know the guy didn't do it, but you're going to execute him anyway? I was speechless.
Yeah. And it happens all the time. And it's so much that the system just overlooks. But I think Mark made a good point when we was in Sundance about what people can do. And that is, one is to get on the jurors.
Yes, yes. Don't avoid jury duty. Yeah. Very true. Very true.
And vote.
Yes.
And let the people know that you're voting for, that you're going to be watching them. Because it's about human nature. I mean, we all human. We make mistakes. And there's no way that you can avoid all mistakes.
But at least you can take responsibility for them when you figure
right.
out. Right. Yeah, that's the bottom line. But we've got some callers, so let's take one now. So, caller, you're on the air.
Hi.
Hello.
Hi, Melody. How are you doing today?
I'm good. How are you?
I'm doing pretty good. One thing that I have been sort of hammering home to everyone this week, and it's just something that I would like people to consider, and it's right along the line of wrongful imprisonment, and that is, I'm not sure if you've heard about these detention centers that Halliburton is going to be building.
I have heard a little bit about that.
Yeah, well, I find that particularly disturbing in light of Bush Sr.'s program with FEMA back in the 80s called Rex 84, where they were also similarly claiming that they were going to imprison only a mass immigration of people who were displaced by a war in Central America. They made the same argument back then, but then when a Senate Oversight Committee looked into it, they said, well, wait a minute, why are you refurbishing Japanese internment camps that are in the northern states if you're worried about people coming up across the southern border? And they said, well, we've sort of expanded our definition to include dissidents and protesters and insurrectionists and
everybody we don't like.
Right, exactly. And so the same guy that Reagan had used as his big communist and Vietnam War protest buster when he was governor of California, a man named Louis Giuffrida was head of FEMA at that time, and he ended up getting fired.
He ended up being head of the FBI.
What's that?
He ended up being head of the FBI.
Oh, is he?
Louis Free? He was.
Giuffrida.
Oh, I'm sorry. I thought you said Louis J. Free. Never mind.
Well, it could be the same guy. It could be the same guy. I'm not sure.
His name is Freeh is his last name, so...
Oh, okay, no,
it's
no, no,
not
no.
the same person.
Okay. But regardless, the point is that last time when they had this program, you know, they made the exact same claim. It's going to be for if there's a mass exodus of people from Central America displaced by a war. And they're saying the exact same thing now, and now Halliburton has this open-ended contract to build as many as they want. They only have one-year contracts, but it can be renewed to extend out to at least 5 years, which is, you know, right around the and just past the 2008 election. And the locations of these places will be hidden, and even the FEMA guy, or the Halliburton guy, rather, said, yeah, and they might be used by the government for other programs.
These great. Attempts. Just great.
So I think this is something the media really, really, really needs to look at, because if that's not going to, you know, if that's not going to wake people up, then I don't know what will. And, I mean, the poor man sitting next to you was wrongfully incarcerated, and even if it is for quote-unquote illegal immigrants, and that's it, and it's not going to be for white people, you know, how the hell is that right? It's obviously not right.
Of course it's not.
Hey, well, but people need to keep in mind that once that starts going on, the government's going to go, geez, wow, we're being allowed to lock these people up and nobody's, you know, bothering. I mean, they did a mass arrest of Muslims a few years ago, and nobody, you know, even made a peep about it, or very few people.
It was very disturbing to me. Well, some people made a peep about it, but nobody that they cared about. You're making some great points there. Well, thanks a lot for your call.
Thank you.
And
yeah.
Hopefully we can turn this all around.
I have no doubt of that. I have no doubt of that. And I think that this is the kind of overreach that's going to eventually cause just the whole house of cards to come tumbling down.
Well, as it did in Mr. Hunt's case, and let's hope that it happens in a lot of other people's as well. Okay, thanks
Absolutely.
A lot. Take care. And let's go ahead and talk to our next caller. You're on the air, caller.
Hello.
Hello.
Yes, two things. One is that... I think that a lot of people aren't just in denial about cultural awareness. I think they just don't even know that, because it's not their experience, so they have no idea. So that's one...
Well, I think the statistics speak for themselves, because there's a hugely disproportionate percentage of African Americans that are incarcerated in this country in comparison to any other ethnic group. And, you know, I don't think that that's pretty hard to miss. But, you know, I think, of course, it plays into some people's racist assumptions. And so they just figure, well, that's the way I've always seen it. So it must be right that, you know, African Americans must all be criminals, and that's why they're in prison. I guess some people assume that. Of course, it's not true. I mean, I don't know. I mean, I think some people don't see anything that they don't want to see.
Right.
You know?
Well, that's what people see. When they see a picture of somebody who's been a killer or something, they see a black person maybe on the TV or something, and it just goes into their subconscious, and they hold their purses a little tighter when they pass or something. I mean, it's just.
Michael Moore did a wonderful thing on this on his TV show a few years ago, where he hired this fellow who lived in Washington, D.C., who was a completely law-abiding guy, and he got pulled over all the time for driving while black, just for being himself.
Right.
And so he put this guy's face on the side of a giant semi, this huge picture, and it said, "Hi, I'm, you know, whatever his name was, and I'm totally innocent of any crime." And this guy rode around on the back of this flatbed and with this loudspeaker says, "Hi, you know, I'm, you know, Bob Jones or whatever, and I'm totally innocent of any crime." Oh, the police.
And
was
I'm
just,
a really nice guy.
They were furious,
what
just furious. And Michael goes, "We just want to be sure that you don't arrest him for anything, because he hasn't done anything." And they really did not find it amusing, but I thought it was very pointed, you know, and very right on, because, I mean, this man, he was just hassled constantly just for being alive and doing nothing.
And again, how often is that repeated in every city in the country?
Many, many times, unfortunately.
One more quick point I want to make was that, unbeknownst to many of us, I think some of us have a little bit of money in the stocks market, and Halliburton is in a whole lot of different mixed annuities and mixed energy sources and things. And so if people want to just check, because they might not know that they're part owner in all of this. And
well, there's a good thought.
It could be surprising if you looked at your portfolio.
It's true. They have their tentacles in many places.
Yes.
All right.
Well,
thanks very much for your call.
Thanks a lot. I think we have another caller.
I do believe we do. 503-231-8187 is the number to call. And just to let you know, this is the moment you can call a different number and win tickets to see The Trials of Daryl Hunt tomorrow at the Hollywood Theater. Again, it's playing tomorrow night
at
7 o'clock. And we do have tickets to give away now. And go ahead and call 503-231-8032.
Are there operators standing
Operator is standing by now.
Okay.
And he's been trained in everything. I just
went
through that.
I'm impressed.
But again, it's the office desk, 503-231-8032 is the number to call to win tickets. Otherwise, you wouldn't be able to get through, as we have people lined up to speak on the air.
Yeah.
So we had to sort of, do some facilities management.
Well, I just want to add one quick piece. I just want to say that the website for our film festival is www.pinefilm.org. And you can get a description of the movie there, any other information on theater location, show times, et cetera, for this film and for all the films in the festival.
Excellent. So I wanted to ask Katie, where are you going next with this film?
Wow. Daryl and I were just talking about how there's no sitting still for the next year.
Sounds like you're going to be very busy.
We actually have a really exciting line of festivals coming up, and we're going to be in Sedona, Arizona. We're going to have the North Carolina premiere at the Full Frame Documentary Film Festival in April. And we're hoping to go to Texas. We'll be doing some work in New York, back on the West Coast.
But you're going to be busy.
Yeah.
You're turning into a world traveler. Yeah. Jet setter.
The whirlwind tour, but yeah.
It's very important.
And we're hoping to do some international.
I was going to say, are you hoping to get it into like Cannes or some other festival?
We'd love to be at Cannes, but
well, you were well received at Sundance, so I don't see that's outside the realm of possibility.
No, our doors are wide open. I think we all feel like there's no ceiling on what we can do with this, and as we've all been saying, it's such a human story, and everyone can relate to some piece of it, which I think makes it beyond powerful, because it's not a criminal justice story. It's not. It doesn't just fit into this one niche. It's human.
Yes.
It's very human. And in fact, a moment that I know I was weeping during the film, towards the end, as the victim, Deborah Sykes' mother, who's been carrying on in keeping track of all of these trials, and who was fairly convinced that, in fact, Daryl was guilty. In one of the very late trials, she appeared very briefly, very combatively, almost like, well, if you are innocent, this was a horrible thing. It was a tough road to hoe, she said, but I don't believe you are. And everyone should know that was sort of the gist of this very terse, very brief statement. And as she's saying that, I have to feel some compassion for her as someone who's lost her daughter, someone who, has undergone, this sort of tragedy, and knowing how that kind of sorrow and grief can twist into anger that clouds one's ability to take in information or compassion or, being rational. This happens. Things break people. But your response, you responded to her in the most profoundly compassionate way. And I was really moved by that. And I was hoping I could maybe get you to comment on that.
Yes. As you were saying, it's so hard for people to really understand unless you lost someone. And she did. She lost her daughter. And on top of that, she was lied to for 20 years.
Right.
Even that was the exoneration hearing. Even an hour before the hearing, she was lied to. They didn't tell her what was going to happen.
Right.
Even though everyone else knew what was going to happen 24 hours before then. they lied to all the way up. And even today, you know, last night, there was other revelations that came out in North Carolina about the same thing. But it's so sad. And as I speak around the country, I tell people, you know, what I do is pray for her, because I would ask that everyone would pray for her, because it's so sad that people, and I'm saying people in Winston-Salem, North Carolina, police department and the attorney's office, treat people in this way, and it happens to all victims.
Mm-hmm.
When injustices happen, because it affects everyone. It just doesn't affect just one person. It affects everyone.
Well, yeah, I mean, it lowers the faith, as you were talking about before, of the community in their elected officials of their police department or whatever, that they're going to do the right thing. And, I mean, I think it does affect everyone. Did they even apologize to you after all this?
No. And
I think at the very least, they owed you an apology.
Well, as I said, I'm still living, so I'm okay.
Yeah, you're getting about it.
They need to apologize to Mrs. Jefferson and be sincere about it. I got to mention it because it's mm-hmm. been on my mind all night. But there was another rape victim. And she was almost murdered. She was stabbed 12 times by the same guy.
Mm-hmm.
And it came out last night. They actually kept her from, and this happened 6 months after Mrs. Sykes was killed. I was in jail just before I was getting ready to go to trial for my life. And the police stopped her from pressing charges against them, because they didn't want for the information to be out, and they wanted to kill me,
mm-hmm.
and so they can be right.
And then they denied her chance to see justice done for herself.
And she just testified before the city manager's commission last night.
Wow.
And revealed what they told her to keep her from.
Right.
Pressing charges.
Do you still call Winston-Salem home when you're not?
Yes, I'm still there. I'm gonna stay there because I don't. As long as they continue to see me, and I'm gonna continue to fight for people who are innocent, and hoping I can save a life.
Good.
That is awesome. I do want to go ahead and let caller have a chance to ask a question or a comment. We have only about 7 minutes left, 6 minutes left. Look at that, ticking away. Good morning. You're on the air.
Good morning. Hello?
Hello.
Hello.
Yeah. A minor point. I have a few minor points. I thought I heard, I think in an interview with Brother Hunt, that when he was released, he only had, gave him a stipend of $1 and change or something like that, and a plastic bag for his clothing. Was that you, my brother?
No. Well, what they did was, when I was released, they gave me $45 gate check and a goodbye.
$45.
Yes.
I think, to your point, caller, that is the common practice. You know, when someone is released, $25. You know, is the going rate in many counties. I was hearing something about $25 I can't remember, like $25 on a bus ticket. You know, I was hearing that like 2 days ago in a news story, and trying to figure out how folks can try to get their lives together with that.
It's just impossible. It's laughable, really.
This is another part of what is wrong with our justice system.
Then I'd like to say, you know, you all there on the radio show, people see you as kind of like icons, you know, and they pay a lot of attention to what you say. And so when people call in with ideas like the sister who was concerned about microwaves being manipulated and stuff like that, mm-hmm. that you shouldn't be anxious to say things, adroitly say things that will invalidate what they're saying, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Even if you make a qualification before, just accept it and don't say anything rather than say things that indicate that maybe they are victims of a conspiracy or something like that, you know.
Yeah, well, you know, actually, I personally didn't, I went out of the way not to invalidate that point because, as I said, we don't
one
know.
One of you did and the other one...
I don't think I ever said that anyone was
but
a victim of a conspiracy.
I really,
no, you didn't
I'm hearing
say
what you're saying.
No, you did not say that. No.
I'm hearing what you're saying, and I absolutely agree with you.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you. And let's go ahead and take another caller. Good morning, you're on the air. Good morning.
Am I on the air?
It's you.
Yes, I would like to make two quick points, but they're very important points.
Okay, we just have 3 minutes left, so do hurry up.
One, until the system is changed so that it is reviewable about the innocence of the person accused, this is not going to change. Because right now, if the trial was fair, the person may be innocent, but he may be legally executed. And mm-hmm. the state that's the worst for that is Texas. Because if you don't raise it within the state of Texas within 1 month, then it is no longer reviewable. Until that changes, we are going to continue to execute vast numbers of innocent people. And until that changes, nothing's going to really happen. And if you don't work towards that point to basically change the system, it has to be more than a quote and unquote fair trial. It has to be about whether this person is actually guilty as a accused. That's mm-hmm. my major point. Because we can't do capital punishment and even do it well, we should abolish it.
Thank you very much for that point.
Excellent. Well, I want to announce Daryl's website for those of you who'd like to follow up more on all this, on the Project for Freedom and Justice that he's engaged in. It's Daryl, DarrylHunt, project.org.
And I'll also just say it, www.thetrialsofdarrylhunt.com. You can contact all of us, and we can let you know when we'll be in your city, as well as link to all our partner organizations and Daryl's site as well. So,
now, I wanted to ask you also, at what point will the movie, do you anticipate that it would be available for people to purchase on DVD?
After an HBO broadcast, so...
You're in 3 months.
So everybody has a year.
Year and a half or so.
A year to hold on to that. Yeah. But in the meantime, we will be probably in a city near you, so contact us.
Wonderful. I really want to thank you all for taking the time to come down
visit
us this morning. And thank you, Daryl, for really the struggle you had. I could talk to you for another half hour.
Yes.
Easy.
Easily.
wish we had some more time. But thank you so much for taking the time to be with us this morning here at KABU.
Well, and thank you to Katie and all the filmmakers for telling Daryl's story on the screen and, you know, sharing it with everybody. That's a huge undertaking, and I think it's more than most people realize. it's a labor of love, and it's much appreciated. So everybody, you want to stay tuned for the APA Compass program that's coming up, and then all the rest of the zine. Then we'll have Democracy Now, as I said, and Moving On. And, you know, I think that, you know, if you can, try to get to go see The Trials of Daryl Hunt tomorrow night.
And to that end, if you are interested in a pair of tickets, do call 503. Never mind.
Oh, they're don't all do that given away.
Anymore.
Too late. Sorry, everybody. Keep on being positively revolting. See you next week.
And it's 9 o'clock. You're listening to KBOO Portland. This KBOO program has been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Ambling Bear Distributor, who distributes and recycles free periodicals. Coming up, APA Compass.
Saturday, February the 11th, the PCC African Film Festival will host a special symposium and community conversation on the African legacy in Mexico. The program will offer the community an opportunity to learn more about the history and cultural influences of the Africans in Mexico. At 10 a.m., the program will start off with a trilogy presented by Mexican film director Rafael Robayar Corona. The trilogy will include his films The Forgotten Root, From Flora to Coahuila, and his work in progress, Incursion into the Hills. In the afternoon, the director and other experts in the fields will speak on the Afro-Mexican identity, followed by a community conversation with local activists and audience members. Both events will be held in the new Moriarty Arts and Humanities Building, Auditorium Room 104, at the Cascade Campus on 705 North Killingsworth Street. This KABU co-sponsored event will be free to the public.